Monday, June 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the World Health Organization is raising more alarms over the coronavirus.
Countries are understandably eager to open up their societies and economies, but the virus is still spreading fast. It is still deadly.
The U.S. Secretary of State is condemning the U.N. Human Rights Council over a resolution on racism. Also ahead, singer Beyoncé drops a meaningful new single in honor of Juneteenth. It's all on today's International Edition. Friday's Juneteenth celebrations across the United States commemorated the day the last enslaved African Americans learned they were free. While the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862 called for the end of slavery, word didn't reach the last enslaved black people until 2 years later on June 19th. This year, Juneteenth celebrations took on greater significance amid weeks of anti-racist protests. VOA's Jason Patinkin filed this report.
It started as a protest and then turned into a party. On Friday, June 19th, Americans celebrated Juneteenth, the day commemorating the end of slavery in the United States 155 years ago. Juneteenth has never been widely celebrated in America outside the black community, but amid weeks of nationwide protests against racism and police brutality, this year the day went mainstream. At the festivities in Washington, D.C., Chris Waya and her friend Ty said this year's Juneteenth celebrations were bigger than any they had experienced before.
I feel blackity black black. I just am so excited and so happy to finally celebrate a day that really truly feels like it's for us. We're making a lot of good growth and leaps and bounds in this short amount of time. People are getting angry in this movement. People are sad and happy, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Yeah. Honestly, I really feel like I'm just truly excited. This is the first year I feel like Juneteenth is actually being celebrated, and it's just so exciting to see so many people of color out here, especially black people that are out here actually supporting. Even though it's a heavy time, it's still exciting to see so many of us celebrating being black.
Numerous U.S. states declared this year's Juneteenth as an official holiday. These include New York, which had slave markets until the 1760s, and Virginia, which until the 1860s allowed slavery of black people. Virginia was also home to the capital of the Confederacy, a group of southern states which rebelled against the United States in a failed attempt to maintain slavery about 160 years ago. In Washington, D.C., Juneteenth revelers tore down a statue of Confederate General Albert Pike. It was the latest in a wave of actions across the country where anti-racist protesters have demolished monuments to the Confederacy. Many Americans are now calling for Juneteenth to be declared a nationwide federal holiday, on par with the 4th of July, which marks America's independence from Great Britain in 1776. At the celebration in Washington, D.C., Jasmine Joshua had this to say.
What brought us here pretty much was the celebration for Juneteenth. Essentially, July 4th isn't really our holiday because we wasn't really free. June 19th is exactly when, you know, we were informed that, okay, hey, everybody's free.
Her partner Jamie D. agreed.
It's very important to make Juneteenth a federal holiday because you have to understand that we have built America from the ground. So it's a day that's actually recognized that we need so we can realize that we're here, we're important, we matter. And at the end of the day, we're not going anywhere because we deserve freedom, peace, and happiness just like anybody else.
Even without the U.S. government's recognition of Juneteenth, many businesses opted to give their workers a paid day off on June 19th. Anthony Marcel, who also attended the D.C. celebration, works for an international law firm based in Europe.
They really didn't know the significance of June 19th, and they declared June 19th a paid holiday for our firm. So, and they actually apologized that they didn't know the significance of June 19th. and immediately declared it a paid holiday. So it takes change like that, local change. We can't expect our federal government to make local changes. Real change starts locally. It starts in its community, and it dominoes effects to on a federal and international level.
Earlier this month, the wider recognition of Juneteenth forced President Donald Trump to postpone his first campaign rally since the COVID-19 outbreak began. Many Americans accused Trump of being racist and said he should not hold a rally on a day that is so important to Black Americans. Trump held the rally on Saturday, June 20th instead, but there was low turnout. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo over the weekend accused the United Nations Human Rights Council of hypocrisy. He called the council's unanimous resolution Friday to commission a report on systemic racism and discrimination against Black people around the world a new low that reaffirms the U.S. decision in 2018 to withdraw from the organization.
Worldwide protests calling for an end to racial injustice following last month's death of George Floyd were part of a catalyst for the request.
Floyd's brother, Philanese, along with more than 600 organizations, appealed to the UN to set up an international probe investigating the killings of Black people in America. The council ultimately declined pressure to single out the United States. Joining us is Tendai Akume, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Racism. Thank you so much for being with us. The council said it was an urgent enough issue to hold only its fifth ever unscheduled debate. That in itself seems pretty significant. How did this all come about?
The uprising which swept the U.S., and I think even in the U.S., we probably, when it started, hadn't realized what the scale would be once it got going, spilled across the borders of the U.S. to other parts of the world, where there's been what we might think of as a transnational uprising against systemic racism in law enforcement and in other areas of life, even though the images of the killing of George Floyd, I think, is one of a number of triggers. Anyone in the world right now would have to be fairly isolated to not have witnessed what's been happening, and I think that had an impact on the request for the urgent debate and then even having that request accepted. The African group is the one that pushed for the tabling of an urgent debate. It's not surprising because this is about forcing nations all over the world to confront what it would mean to take seriously the proposition that Black Lives Matter. And so when you look at the letter requesting the scheduling of this urgent debate, it highlights the circumstances of people of African descent in different parts of the world. But I think the request for an urgent debate where the urgent debate centers a hegemon like the U.S., you know, that is not trivial at the U.N. level to have countries come out and say, we want to have a conversation about what's happening in a really powerful veto-holding nation. And then there's been an outcry by independent experts and even by the body that is in charge of the treaty that we have at the international level prohibiting discrimination. They've all come out and said the situation in the U.S. is deeply troubling and requires urgent human rights attention. And then you add to that the fact that George Floyd's family, and it's not just his family, it's the family of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Philando Castile. It's a number of families who've all lost a loved one to police violence. They've all been very personally affected. They, along with over 600 human rights organizations, basically said to the UN, we want a commission of inquiry addressing the situation. I've made a similar request. I think the families are right. The situation in the U.S. does require and would benefit from an international human rights body that could work with national and local authorities to really bring the U.S. into compliance with human rights standards, which it is not at the moment. What's troubling is that in the urgent debate, some powerful countries working behind the scenes to curtail the kind of meaningful intervention that would be required in this situation.
It's sort of stunning just to have this conversation at all. The Human Rights Council taking up an urgent debate on human rights violations in the United States.
I think that that's true, and I think we have to ask ourselves why it's so remarkable. What are the ways of understanding human rights violations, where they occur, how they occur, that make that so stunning? And there's been some people who've opposed a commission of inquiry from a human rights perspective, saying, look, the situation just isn't serious enough. And I can't buy those kinds of arguments. I mean, I would put it to anybody to identify a human rights problem that has triggered this scale of transnational international mobilization against it, and even national mobilization, the concern with the kinds of violations that have taken people out into the streets in the face of a pandemic, to me speak to how serious the violations that are at stake are, and how these violations are not just about bad actors. What's under trial right now is the very systems, the laws that mean that police can engage in this behavior and not be held accountable, right? So there's a problem with the frameworks as well. I think part of the surprise is that there are assumptions of ways of understanding powerful countries like the U.S. as perhaps being in general on the right side of human rights, and so we don't have to worry about them. And what the situation reveals is that that analysis really depends on which side of U.S. power you're on. So for the family of George Floyd articulates an existential type of violence and threat that they're experiencing. For them, I doubt that they are surprised. If anything, I think they're surprised that their pleas are potentially being heard.
Is it simply symbolic, or does it go any further than that?
My theory of social change is that true change and meaningful change happens on terms that often actually are hard to predict as you're approaching the moment. And then it's like you look back into the past and you say, yeah, you know, it makes sense that that was the level or the trigger that got us to the world that we are in now. I mean, think about even just the uprising that we have nationally and globally. Even after the pandemic began, I would be surprised if you could find anyone who would have bet any kind of money that we would be in the world that we are in now. I take that approach to these kinds of interventions as well. With the Commission of Inquiry, it wouldn't be the cure-all that just at the last minute comes in and saves the situation and ensures that systemic racism is abolished in the U.S. Anything that is presented in those terms, I think we should be suspicious of. We're dealing with something that's really, really deeply rooted, and this is not just in the U.S., in other places as well. Issues of systemic racism are hard to grapple with precisely because they are systemic. But what that does mean is that I think we need a multi-strategic approach. The work that movements have been doing in this country is powerful, is important, and I think will continue to be the driving engine of meaningful change. And what we're seeing here is that people within the Black Lives Matter movement, including George Floyd's family, have sought assistance from the international community. And I think they're right to believe that a commission of inquiry at the international level just provides an additional resource that might actually make a difference on the ground. And in very concrete ways, within the human rights system, there's actually standards, anti-racism standards, policing standards, there's all kinds of standards that exist that the U.S. is currently not in compliance with. So even if it's just a resource, another place that local, national, and movement actors can look to ensure that there is accountability and change on the ground, I think that's really valuable. And I think assuming or thinking that the Commission of Inquiry is going to solve the problem or kind of swoop in, I think that's the wrong way to think about its value. And I think we should all feel humbled in terms of the assumptions that we have about what it is that catalyzes change and what does not catalyze change, given how we've gotten here in the first place. Real change happens when you lay the foundation for different kinds of levers for getting from point A to point B.
Tendai Yakume, United Nations Special Rapporteur, thank you so much. As protests against racial discrimination continue in many American cities, President Donald Trump returned to the campaign trail in Tulsa, Oklahoma on Saturday. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, the president's desire to get back to a sense of normalcy across the country has been tempered by a spike of COVID-19 cases in many U.S. states.
Before a crowd of thousands of supporters at the Bank of Oklahoma Center in Tulsa, President Donald Trump acknowledged the increasing number of coronavirus cases in the country.
When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases.
The president's desire to get the country opened back up after months of restrictions was met with enthusiastic support by those attending his rally.
Let's open the schools, please. Open.
As health officials continue to monitor the growing number of COVID-19 infections, gatherings and protests against racial discrimination and police brutality continue across the country, with demonstrators removing statues, including those honoring Confederate leaders from the U.S. Civil War. U.S. Senator from South Carolina, Republican Tim Scott, who is working to draft police reform legislation, says more funding to law enforcement agencies, not less, is needed at the federal level.
If you want officers to be trained effectively, you have to give them the tools called training to get there. That requires more resources. We know that if you want more information on the federal level, that requires more resources for record keeping.
Scott also says federal funding would ensure law enforcement agencies follow the legislation.
It is important for us to use the resources that we provide to law enforcement in a way to get them to compel them towards the direction that we think is in the best interest of the nation, of the communities that they serve, and frankly, of the officers themselves.
As lawmakers continue to work to reform law enforcement practices both political parties can agree on, it comes at a time when much of Washington is digesting the revelations in former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book, The Room Where It Happened, offering an insider look at the Trump administration. The book is an unflattering portrayal of President Trump's leadership.
But I think that that lack of touch, that lack of sensibility and judgment that Trump, that John Bolton talks about, you can see in his handling of the public protests after George Floyd's murder 3 weeks ago.
White House advisor Peter Navarro dismisses many of the accusations Bolton makes in his book.
He got fired because he did not obey the chain of command, because his views were totally out of sync with President Donald J. Trump with respect to how to handle international affairs. And he's basically breaking all manner of tradition in terms of issuing a book at this stage. And he's going to make a bunch of money.
The Department of Justice tried to block the release of Bolton's book over concerns it contained classified information. But a federal judge ruled Saturday the publication's release could move forward. Kane Faribault, VOA News.
World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is warning the global coronavirus pandemic is continuing to accelerate. He is urging people to maintain social distancing and use extreme vigilance.
Countries are understandably eager to open up their societies and economies, but the virus is still spreading fast. It is still deadly.
Brazil has the world's worst outbreak outside of the United States, but Tedros said there are also a large number of new cases coming from South Asia and the Middle East. Public health experts say the U.S. may not be experiencing a second wave of coronavirus cases because the first wave, they say, isn't over yet. The U.S. has over 2.2 million infections being reported and the highest death toll at about 120,000, according to Johns Hopkins University. UN officials on the occasion of World Refugee Day are warning the COVID-19 pandemic poses an additional threat to millions of refugees and displaced people, among the most vulnerable in the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More people live in forced exile than ever before. The UN Refugee Agency says refugees account for nearly 30 million of the record-breaking 79.5 million uprooted by conflict and persecution. An overwhelming majority live in poor countries with fragile economies and health systems. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says refugees' living conditions put them at particular risk of coronavirus infection.
They often have limited access to adequate shelter, water, nutrition, sanitation, and health services.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi agrees with this assessment. However, he notes most refugees are not in camps, but in communities with local people. In some places, he says, those communities have been devastated by the pandemic.
I'm thinking of Latin America, where 17, 18 countries host more than 4 million Venezuelans on the move. I'm thinking of many urban centers in Africa that are host to large refugee populations. I'm thinking of Afghans in Pakistan and Iran that share facilities and accommodation with communities that have been impacted very severely by COVID.
Grandi says he also is extremely concerned about the impact of COVID-19 on livelihoods. He says most refugees have lost their jobs because of lockdowns and other measures. He says refugees who have lost their incomes cannot pay for health care. It is of utmost importance, he says, for governments to include refugees, displaced people, and other people on the move in their national health responses to the pandemic. He says this is key to stopping the pandemic, noting the coronavirus makes no distinction between citizens of a country and those who have been forcibly uprooted from their homes and live within their midst. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The first plane load of international students to return to Australia since COVID-19 border closures is due to touch down in Canberra next month. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The planned return of about 350 foreign students would be the first major reopening of Australia's tightly sealed international borders. Since March, only citizens and permanent residents have been allowed to return. They must go into mandatory quarantine in a hotel for 2 weeks. Foreign nationals have been banned under COVID-19 restrictions. Under a plan approved by the Australian Capital Territory, the regional authority that governs Canberra and the surrounding area, a chartered flight would bring the students from a major travel hub in Asia, possibly Singapore. They too would be sent into isolation for 14 days and would be tested for the new coronavirus at the beginning and end of their stay before being allowed to resume their studies. Paddy Nixon, Vice-Chancellor and President of the University of Canberra, said strict health protocols would be followed.
We've had to engage not just with the medical officers here in the ACT, but also with the federal government to ensure that we comply with all their expectations, regulations and protocols, and to ensure both the safety of the students, but also of our community at large.
Education is one of Australia's most lucrative enterprises, generating billions of dollars each year. However, COVID-19 restrictions, which have helped Australia mostly contain the disease, have damaged the sector. It's hoped the pilot program will lay the groundwork for large-scale arrivals of students in the months ahead. Chinese students make up about a third of all international enrolments at Australian universities. Earlier this month, they were warned by China's Education Ministry that Australia was no longer a safe place to study because of racism spurred by the pandemic, which first emerged in Wuhan. The government in Canberra said such discrimination was perpetrated by a tiny minority of cowardly idiots. Australia's international borders are expected to stay closed to tourists for the rest of the year. Just over 7,400 confirmed coronavirus cases have been recorded in Australia. The vast majority of patients have recovered, but 102 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. In a blow to Hong Kong's protest movement, pro-democracy labor unions and a student group have failed to garner enough support to hold strikes against looming national security legislation imposed by Beijing. After a year of often violent unrest, anti-government demonstrators have lost momentum due to the higher risk of arrest. Coronavirus restrictions have prompted police to prohibit large crowds. After a failed effort in the U.S. Supreme Court, the Trump administration plans to try again to end the Dreamers program that protects undocumented immigrants brought to the United States illegally as children. President Trump said Saturday his administration will resubmit plans to end the policy, which he views as unlawful. As coronavirus restrictions are lifted, Pope Francis said Sunday in his address in St. Peter's Square, the drastic reduction in pollution around the world during lockdowns should lead to greater concern for the environment. Francis said the pandemic made many people reflect on their relationship with the environment. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi warned Saturday that Cairo would not allow militias fighting for Libya's UN-recognized government in Tripoli to capture the coastal port town of Sirte or the Jufra air base. Sisi's warning came as Tripoli-based Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj met with Algerian President Abdelmajid Tebboune Saturday amid diplomatic efforts to forestall a looming conflict over Sirte and oil installations further east. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi insisted Saturday in a speech to Egypt's armed forces that Cairo would defend its security along a 1,200-kilometer common border with Libya, aided by friends and allies, including Libya's traditional tribal forces. Sisi added that Egypt does not covet any Libyan territory and its only objective is to support security and stability inside Libya and prevent mercenaries and terrorists from entering Egypt. He called on forces from each of Libya's rival governments to observe a ceasefire and begin negotiations towards a political settlement. He calls on rival Libyan forces to halt any attempts to advance and to resume talks aimed at a permanent political agreement. He says that Egypt will not accept any attempt by Tripoli forces to capture the port city of Sirte or the Al-Jufra air base in central Libya. Same time Saturday, media loyal to Eastern Commander General Khalifa Haftar showed video of armored forces that it claimed were heading toward territory controlled by its rivals west of Sirte. Meanwhile, UN-backed Libyan Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj made a one-day visit to neighboring Algeria to discuss a possible mediation effort by President Abdelmajid Tebboune. The Algerian president met with the head of the Libyan parliament, Aquila Sala, an ally of Eastern Commander General Khalifa Haftar, earlier in the week. Sarraj vetoed an Egyptian proposal to hold an emergency session of the Arab League to discuss foreign intervention in Libya. Rami Abdul Rahman, who heads the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, said Saturday that Turkey has now sent 15,000 Syrian mercenaries to fight in Libya. VOA could not independently confirm the figure. A Turkish delegation met with Prime Minister Sarraj and his government several days ago, reportedly discussing a multi-billion dollar trade deal. Egypt, France, and the United Arab Emirates, which support General Haftar, are concerned about any oil drilling concessions granted by Sarraj to Turkey in the eastern Mediterranean. The U.S. at the same time has said it is concerned about the presence of several thousand Russian mercenaries and a number of Russian warplanes now based at Haftar's Al-Jufra air base. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches at the University of Paris, tells VOA that France has tried to make the case with Washington that allowing Turkish forces a major foothold in Libya is a strategic mistake. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And superstar Beyoncé gifted fans on Friday for a Juneteenth surprise new single called Black Parade. The singer plans to have proceeds from the song go to help black-owned small businesses, dozens of which have been posted on her website. You're listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
country, AU, African Union. Can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Session. Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.